Yeah, right. Okay, we're back on. Just want to give you some information that we can pick from our brains about this. I'm sorry that we don't have information that you really need documentation, but Air University wrote me and told me that they had, temporarily misfiled or do reorganization. They lost it. But life support started off on 8th, 12th, and 15th Air Force in Europe. We were using parachute riggers, and they had they did personal equipment work at that time. And the MOS for parachute rigger, of course, was a 620, and a life support man or a personal equipment technician was a 594. And you got a K8 letter put on there if you could operate a sewing machine and a V if you were a rigger. 594 KV is what the last one I had before we went to military occupational specialist numbers, which became 922s. Now, at that time, when we had an officer's course running out at Camp Ellis, where we turned life support officers, and I think that it was a 10-420.
10-420, correct.
10-420 MOS.
That changed to 1415.
1415A or something like that, or 1514. Anyway, it was a home for navigators. But anyway, the life support school started gradually. We just weaned away from parachute rigging, and they had all that life support display where they had the backpack survival kits that were attached to the parachute and some that were set to the old seat style chutes. And aside from tack and chutes, then we got into attaching working with the life rafts, the old B5 life preserver vest, and the B1 and the B2, and the A1, B1, C1 survival packs in the back with a can of rations and some 45 buckshot and a couple other things. And then we started working with G suits. We got into anti-exposure suits as the Air Force became more sophisticated. We got into life rafts, and we got into a lot of aircrew clothing, helmets. We got into fitting helmets in the early stages and sending them off to, what was the company that made the helmets? The first fitted helmets were lined with leather, and the Air Force team got them. The Thunderbirds got them specially first. Bell helmet? Bell? I don't remember, but anyway. Dawn and I are just going to interject. It was just rambling, and maybe you could pick something out of it and make sense. But now we're talking about 1951, we were parachute riggers, and in August of 1952, the life support school, as we know it, Don Bach and I and a number of other instructors got our MOS at that time. On August of 1952, we became 922s. 922s and 921s, we picked up both. We got a crack at both AFSCs at that time, because if you did the survival training, you were a 921. If you did the life support business, you were a 922, or personal equipment. So we, most of the staff, if they went through STED, or I can't think of what it was, Out of Mountain Home, some went to Florida, some went to Fort Benning and got parachute training in addition to other things. Lieutenant Eccles, Bobby D. Gillespie, Dale Donovan Bryant, and Forrest O. Newcomb went out to Colorado Springs and went to the Army School of Cold Weather in conjunction with Lowry Air Force Base and the Army, the 10th Mountain Division. In this period of time, we trained a cadre, and they got their medical training background down in Florida at MacDill, and I think they went to forgot where the School of Aviation Medicine was, Gunter, down at Gunter Air Force Base in Alabama. And when they came back, we got into tracheotomies and all of that stuff, if you remember some of the you guys that went through that. We spent quite a bit of time on medical. We moved along. Vern Martin was the principal instructor for the life support course at that time, and then, of course, Bill Wilcoxon came along, and then Don Bach came along, and it just kind of metamorphosed as people moved on to other jobs. We kind of took it over. Don and I took our initial instructor training. The one that really counted was down at Gunner Air Force Base in Alabama, and that got us going. The school evolved as we went along. Let's see, we're talking about 52, 54. We were out of Stead. We did some survival training at Camp Ellis in Ipava, Illinois. We did some up on the Snake River in Idaho. We sent people to Florida. We did kind of a lot of it out. But then the biggest part was, and you'll remember this, Tom, is Stead Air Force Base, the 3904th Training Squadron. And it was a composite wing. And they did all of the training. And Don's got a one of their guidebooks for SAC land survival. Remember, SAC was going to go one way with the B-36s, and then they were going to evade and survive and make their way back. This copy is 8 July 1952.
Oscar, any of the data I have here is available if Tom can use it.
Yeah.
I'd send any of it because I don't need to keep it.
Yeah, we've got things like Don just said. We've got sun, sand, and survival, and analysis of survival experience in desert areas. Probably could have used that here a little while ago. And down in the north, this is out of the Air University. All of these ADTIC publications are in the 50s, 53. A lot of stuff is, remember old Brent Balchin and Paul Nesbitt was the chief of ADTIC at that time. Aircraft procedures for emergency over water, then the Department of Air Force 64-6, 64-5, 64-3. We have the whole 64 series. Books, CAP copied some stuff out of our thing and made it land and sea emergencies. Third edition called... So there's a lot of stuff out about life support in general, but what happened was the thing evolved. At first, we ran. The curriculum was such that we did PT. We ran. I was one of the few running staff sergeants because Glenn LaCrosse liked to watch me run. Tech Sergeant LaCrosse, our friend and benefactor. We had guys like Dale Bryant, Tech Sergeant Dale Bryant, who went off over into Air Rescue Service finally and retired, now living in Denver, Colorado. We had Tony Goba, who was excellent, a survival type person who unfortunately died of carbon monoxide poisoning a couple years ago. Still the itinerant ski bum, I guess, to the end, taking pictures and bumming around, having a good time. We kept working on this thing, and we went from where we were turned really deeply into medical stuff. If you remember, we talked about tracheotomies. We used the Medical and Surgical Technician's Handbook, TM8230. I got it in my memory because Glenn LaCrosse used to talk about have me name the hand bones and the ribs and the bones in the spinal column and all of that stuff. A lot of our guys went into Stead and stayed there, and then when it moved on up into Washington, it became
Fairchild.
At Fairchild, and Chuck Lehman went, and of course then a lot of us went to the survival schools, like I ran the Caesar Scott Survival School at Okinawa. Chief Williamson ran it, Lester Williamson ran it before I did. The Jungle School in Panama, the Jungle School that Fred Ewing ran in the Philippines. The Vietnam War really gave us life supporters a chance to evolve into where we really did what we're set out to do technically. A war provides you the opportunity to try techniques, improve equipment, and we had a hell of a good system going for what we had. The state of the art at that time, we saved an awful lot of people's lives, and we got a lot of people back that we might not have never gotten back. Unfortunately, there are people that are still out there. The POW issue was a thorny thing. And you know from working down in TSOPW about some of the workings of that. And I really can't remember much other than, you know, we did field training at Camp Ellis in Illinois and the town of Ipava. It was an old army base. It was called, Camp Ellis. And it reverted back to civilian control. We had an accident out there where Sergeant Overson, Orrin T. Overson, drowned and Lieutenant Robert A. Thompson drowned.
In the Spoon River.
And I became commander, first sergeant, everything overnight for about 10 minutes till they They got somebody who was responsible there. What happened is we had students, teams in the field. The ranking officer became the commander and took over the search. It was a kind of a nasty thing because we didn't find Thompson or Sergeant Overson until the next day. The fish went to work on them, catfish for a while. But anyway, that closed that school pretty much effectively, and then the life support school, we came back into Chanute, and we started using STED, and then we started, when funds got real, when we couldn't send people out to Spokane, out to Washington, to Fairchild, then we started doing training on Chanute Air Force Base per se, out on the other end. Now what I think is, Tommy, when you write your newsletter, and I intend to send you some money for stamps. Donna and I were thinking that it'd be nice if we could have, you know, you were talking about some kind of a reunion where we get all the old life supporters together at some central place, all of us could come and have one last big hoorah before we all fade into the distance, because we're getting shaky in the early 60s here, and I don't know if we'll make it through this, the terrible 60s or not, but hopefully we'll all survive. But in the meantime, we need to get together so we can visit and talk, take some pictures, tell a bunch of lies, have a good time. I was thinking about some questions you might ask in your flyer. One would be to ask, did you come straight out of basic into the basic life support course at Chanute? Who were your instructors? What years did you go? Were you assigned, what unit were you assigned to when you left Chanute? Or did you go directly to a fighter outfit, a bomber outfit, or what? And did you stay in life support? Remember we picked up a bunch of retrainees. You can ask them, where are you a retrainee? What was your rank when you came into us? Where did you go? How long did you stay? You might ask them questions about, you know, if you were in Vietnam or any of the other wars, the ensuing wars here, do you have any people that you know directly that you saved? Did you work in escape evasion side of the business? Did you work in life support per se, or did they spin you off into operations in something else? Some of us got, some of the people I talked to over the years had gotten worked out of life support off in another area. Sergeant Hardcastle, who was a retrainee into life support and was an instructor with us, went to Thailand, became an air operations officer down at I can't think of the name of the town where the airport was, the aerial port of entry in Thailand. He went back over into air operations, and he had been a former POW. It's interesting that a lot of the instructors we had in that age group were former POWs that came up to teach escape and evasion originally. Guys like Skretting Land, Odd Bjerke, and Marvin Sprake was a Navy chief that came and stayed with us, got all our information, and the bastard went back to the Navy and retired there. But he set up a good program. He picked our brains on this life support thing, and he stayed two enlistments with us, and then he went back to the Navy as a master chief and finished up his time there. We've got a lot of interesting people who are now retired, and it would be nice maybe if you could pick up, ask them some questions. When did you come into the, you know, life support area and that sort of thing? And that's about all I can think of. We just can't pin down dates. I went to, the school was running full bore, and I went to Germany in May of 1955, and we had just signed, the war was over with Germany at the end of that month. I got there in the first part of the May, so I got the Army Occupation Ribbon or something. And then I went down to Bad Tölz and worked in an escape and evasion school down there as a 922 because I had a 921 secondary MOS, a 92171, a staff sergeant. I worked E&E for a year and a half. Then I came back to Rhine, Maine, and I went to work in a personal equipment shop for the 7167th Air Transport Squadron. And Leister Williamson was a master sergeant, and he was a parachute rigger, and all they had in the life support shop at that time, a parachute rigger. So I told him, hey, I'm a 9-2-1-2-2. I'm taking this over. And the Six Stripes never went, you know, took too much shit from four. So real quick, he got himself on a personnel action memorandum, them PAMs they used to put at. He got himself to be the head hog and picked up a 92270 overnight by a printing machine. But Leister's done us a lot of good. And like I say, I replaced him when I come out of Vietnam to run the Sea Survival School at Kadena. So maybe we can just kind of, maybe you can think to ask some leading questions to the old farts and see if we can kind of piece together and maybe find significant dates when things change. See, later on, then finally we didn't do any survival training, no field survival training at all, and we finally just got away from it completely. And then, you know, then we started into ejection seat training and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff out there. If we could pick people's brains and kind of make a compendium of it, it might be interesting for a record or something, or bring these things up in a newsletter. That's about all I have. I'm sorry. Vern Martin and Don and I had gotten this done before Thanksgiving and had got some pretty factual information down, but since then, it's gone. You know, memory doesn't hold very long, and the paperwork I had is gone. I had written down a bunch of stuff over the years of things that I thought might be put into a record someplace. If we can't get it out of Air University, I guess we're just not going to get it. And like I say, it would be nice if we could get together before the sun sets on all of us and our widows get that nice big flag. I don't have anything more to say, Don. Tom, I've been talking to Don about this for a couple months. He doesn't get your newsletter. Give him your, just yell it after your address.
Okay, Tom, I'm located at 1325 Laurel, L-A-U-R-E-L Drive, here in Rantoul, zip code 61866. Telephone, area code 217-892-2231.
Okay, good. And he knows where Fickenworth and some of the other people are, so we'll try to get together, pass a word around.
It's February the 3rd now, Tom. A mailman just came by my door and dropped off the first tape. So I want you to listen, if you've listened to this one first, and then listen to the other one. That's the original tape that we had with the good information on it. As I told you, the envelope came back, you know, the bubble pack came back with a hole ripped in it. Well, somewhere in the local post office, I guess, this tape, when it came back with the torn bubble pack, the tape had fallen out. And someone had put it on postmaster's desk, and he's a friend of mine, and I had it taped, life support info, and on the tape, and he remembered me. He used to be our mailman at Tonsonut. And he called me and said, weren't you in life support? He said, I think that's where you used to be. So he brought it over to the house. So we've got everything. You've got this tape with a whole bunch of rambling on it. And then this other one is the original tape that we made when we had Vern Martin there. And I think that will provide you with a good foundation of information that you want. I'm enclosing some money for some stamps. Say hello to Polly for me. And I know your boys are already grown up and gone. I hope they're sending home checks to you. If you've trained them right, they'll be sending money home to you. And I'll try to give you a call one of these days on the phone. As a matter of fact, I think I'll call you tonight and tell you about this, and then I'll box this up this time, put it in a box, and send the tapes to you. And I'll mark the one that you should read first, or listen to first, this one, and then the other one will have the information in it. And thanks so much for keeping us posted with a newsletter coming down through the years, and I really appreciate it. And I hope that we can get together, get organized, and get together and have a big kind of a life support soiree someplace where we can all get to. And I hope we're all alive to do it. Thank you, Tom, and take care.